Call, please.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Yvette Itu.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Three members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please join us in the pledge.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And if I may have a motion to approve our minutes from October 19th, subject to any amendment.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Sir.
Thank you. Commissioner, I wasn't able to get the minutes report. Excellent. We're going to review the first 10 months of the fiscal year. The month ended October 31st, 2023. The information was in your packet. I just wanted to do a few of the highlights for you this morning. When you go to the first page, this is our consolidated view. And if you look at the top right there, just over $19 million up in property tax collection. That's between about 24.5%, which is about 4% higher than we thought. We were thinking it'd be about 20%, ended up 24.5% higher than the previous year. And we're pretty well collected for the year now. You can see we had the collection finished a little bit earlier this year, which is why there's a small amount in October. Last year, there was still a lagging amount, but we're pretty well all in. If you look down at the next line, charges for services, we're up 15% of the 4.6 million. It's kind of spread throughout the organization. Zoo accounts for 1.4 million of that. Golf accounts for about 2 million of that. And enterprise accounts for about 1 million of that. And we're going to go through that in more detail when we talk about each of those operating units. And I did want to point out that given the favorable interest rate, that environment we're seeing right now, today we've got just over $4 million in investment earnings. Last year at this time it was 1.7 million, so we're 2.3 up. And some of the commissioners that have been on the board for a longer period of time would remember when this number used to be less than $1 million for the whole year. So this is very favorable. I am paying attention to the rates and they are starting to come down a little bit. So we might not be able to generate as much earnings, but I think being actively managed is allowing us to pick up a few $1 million there. You'll notice that total revenues year to date is 31.5% higher on a consolidated basis than last year. Expenses are 15.5% higher. That 16% differential is what's driving this $26 million increase in performance. And the last thing, I just want to point out the construction. We've had increased construction this year. We've talked about it often, but it's always good to make sure that everyone in the public hears that we've done a major project, Susie's Bear Hollow, so it's theirs. We're doing lots of work out of Manakinki, and those two projects, in addition to all the other things we do, are what's driving that increase in capital spending. Now we'll go through a couple of the individual. First, we'll go to the zoo. And you'll see that year to date, revenues are up in terms of admissions, 4.82%. So that's going very well. We think that'll hold. I do want to point this out because it was down a little bit this month, and this story's going to hold true for golf also. Weather-wise, October was not a great month, and I kind of looked at this out of curiosity. That was interesting because we had 7 rain days this year, 8 rain days last year. Ironically, the rain days in October of 2022, none of them fell on a Saturday or Sunday. Yeah. 3 of them fell on a Saturday or Sunday this year, and 2 fell on a Friday. I'm learning, this is especially talking to golf people, overcast days, cloudiness plays into it also, and this year we had 15 cloudy days, last year 10. So when you look at October of 2020, we had 22 days, which is just not very nice. We had 9 nice days to make money at the zoo and in golf. So that clearly is what drove that for this month. And I won't repeat that. The same will happen in golf. The Zoo Society payment, this is just timing. We're just up a little bit. They'll catch up with us in November, but they send over our share of the membership revenues. And it's just on a little bit different cycle. We're missing by about a month. So that's why that's the way it is. But year-to-date revenues are up, compliments to the zoo, 11%, and expenses are up 7.5%. So you've got 4.5% differential, which is what's creating that improvement in a performance of almost $77,000. And that's where we've mentioned that's primarily the bears right there. Golf. You'll see the same thing. We're down a little bit this month, but year to date, they're up 15.8% in greens fees. We've talked about the rounds. I won't go through that. I know you've got a long agenda, but long story, very short, the rounds are up dramatically. Total revenue's up 20% for golf. When greens fees are up, it drives all of these other revenue sources also. And expenses are up only 13.6%. I like to believe that that 7% differential is what's driving this $1 million performance. And I'm sorry, $1 million increase in performance this year. And I did want to point out, we did have a lot of work going on at Manakiki this past month, as well as the irrigation system and the management centers, which drive all of that. A few of the golf courses that are really outperforming: Sleepy Hollow is up 48% year over year. Shawnee is up 44% year over year, and Seneca is up 47% year over year. That's not to imply that our other courses are not doing well. They're all up, but those were the three that were up the most, over 40% year over year. You'll notice Ironwood. We took ownership of Ironwood on
November 3rd
and started. We've already started making revenue, but we had been accumulating some expenses. We went ahead in the accounting system and set it up. So you'll see that even though we didn't have ownership as of October 31st, we had accumulated some expenses and getting set that up already. Those are some expenses. Next month, we'll see a full month of operation for Ironwood, but those are some expenses we have already incurred. Mm-hmm. Concession revenue is up in enterprise 34%. And we've mentioned this, we're gonna zero in on the next slide. A lot of it's due to Merwin's. Merwin's is just really having a very good year. Total revenues are up $1 million, which is 20%. Expenses are up 15%. Again, that's a good recipe when you can increase 20% on the revenue side, 15% on the expense side. That's gonna lead to a $230,000 outperformance this year over year, 10 months. And there's Marlins, and it's quite a turnaround. This is where they were through 10 months last year. This is where they are through 10 months this year. And it's all driven, just look at the top line. Their sales are really, really strong right now through 10 months. Obviously, expenses go up. You've got commodities that you're selling as well as staffing, but truly a great turnaround. And then the last thing I wanted to point out, and though this is not a huge turnaround, it's a 7% increase down here in Huntington. And you can see on the top line how revenues have really gone up. Expenses have gone up also, but with all the work that's been done at Huntington, the increased traffic, I like to view that that's a success story, even though the number's not as big as the number at Merwin's. As we look at all of our different enterprise operations, it's finding ways to improve them a little bit here and a little bit there. In this case, 7% leads to performance from $86,000 in net to 92. And so we look at that throughout the Park District. I know Joe Rozak and the operations team do. And so that's what we're trying to do in every operation. And Huntington's just a good example of how. And now that we've made the improvements at Huntington, I think you're going to see that number even go up next year. And then the last slide, we had not shown this before, but what I want to include is this is our retail operation, kiosks and other sales. And the big reason I wanted to show this is you can see revenue through 10 months is up almost $126,000. We have the mobile vehicle now that can sell swag and things like this. And there were some questions earlier before the meeting started about how are we doing. We're doing well. And as we continue to find ways to sell our items online, collaborate between our various units, get out into the community, this number will go up even more. But I wanted to compliment the retail team. They are really doing well this year in terms of that's almost a 29% increase in sales just through the first 10 months of this year.
Can I go back? Would you mind going back to Manakiki for a second?
Sure.
The question I had is when we look at some things, we look at the capital expenditures and sort of what we get back from it. So if you look at how are we, I mean, isn't it going to be a long time before we get the CapEx we're spending on that? And particularly, let's take the place that the barn that short that that stores the carts.
Mm-hmm.
I would think we'd want the carts to pay for that, you know, to bump up the carts. So the cost of the carts.
So Dan, you know, the golf essentially is, you know, producing revenue back to the system. The system then invests the net profits back into the system. So that is actually cash. So, you know, we're not looking at an amortization over 20 years as far as yeah. payback. We're paying for it with the proceeds. So we're essentially reinvesting every year into each property in a very unique way. So when you look at Manikiki in particular, the maintenance facility by far was the oldest and worst that we had in our system. Your comment about the golf carts, if we don't protect them, it's hard to keep them in decent shape. These will be electric as well, and so they will have a payback on them. So each one of the things we've done under the enterprise, it isn't necessarily being funneled by the general fund. It's being funneled by
the enterprise as a whole.
Yes.
What my suggestion is could we possibly look at this as being a Manikiki cart expense? And just jack up the carts. That's not you want to look at it as a whole.
Well, again, we look at it as a total system with 9 golf courses, and we look at the positioning between Manikiki and Sleepy Hollow. We look at the next level of courses, and so we try to remain very competitive. Having said that, these new carts will be the top end with GPS, so there will be a modest adjustment along the way.
Yeah. Well explained. Thanks.
I'm sorry, I kind of went quickly. I didn't know, were there any other questions? That's all I had after I hit retail.
I just want to ask a general question about the expenses and when they incur, when they get incurred on this chart. So your capital expenses, at what point do the capital expenses show up here? Are they when they're encumbered, or are these amortized costs?
Commissioner, excellent question. Everything that you see at our monthly board meeting is on a cash basis.
Cash basis.
We report on a cash basis throughout the year. When we do our annual financial statements at the end of the year, we do a GAAP conversion. So we accrue all, we book all the accrued liabilities, we book all the accrued revenues. Our auditors come in and opine. So the financial statements will go through as of 12/31 will be on an accrual basis.
So when we're approving contracts and they get encumbered, how do they get reflected here so that we have a sense of cash basis? And here are the additional contracts that are encumbered. Is that shown on these statements at all?
That's not shown on these. So when we encumber a contract, before we can come to you, I have to assert and tell you that we have cash in hand. You say we want to use this cash for that. That goes in a separate bucket. I'll call it a bucket, separate account. And then it can't be used for anything else. And it's secured there as we do the construction of the project, which could go on a year or two. And we're going to go through that. When I do the budget highlights and we talk about the budget next month, there's a whole lot of things that Sean will be bringing forward as it relates to capital projects that go multi-year.
Perfect. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wade. The very first action item we have is 2023 budget adjustment number 11. Wade.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. And I apologize, commissioners. My mic was not on initially. You'll find budget adjustment 11 at the top of page 9. It's in the amount of $438,753. The detail for the adjustment is in pages 54 through 57. It's one of our smaller adjustments. I would just ask your approval of that.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item falls on the bottom portion of page 11. As the Park District has done for quite a number of years, we declare surplus items. And we also do operations of sales through GovDeals, permissive and live, and single source purchase of used vehicles throughout an entire year. So we found very creative ways to sell the items that the Park District is disposing of, as well as asking for the ability to be able to purchase used vehicles through equipment auctions across the country. So we find very unique ways to basically balance our entire fleet. The recommended action, if there are no questions, falls in the mid portion of page 11 to enter in the to the services auction with GovDeals and approve the live auction and then single source for purchase of equipment.
Just a quick question. We have 350,000 estimated or requested for 2024. What was the cost of the vehicles purchased or do estimate of purchased in 2023? Do we know? Is it in that ballpark?
Commissioner, I don't know exactly, so I don't want to quote a number, but if I can, I'll follow it. I'll follow up and get you the exact number.
So the net normally out of the total amount in the single source is what we sell. So that number goes back into buying new, and then we have an allocation of well over $1.5 million to buy vehicles throughout the entire park district through the entire year. So the 350 is essentially the sale of vehicles.
Perfect. Thank you.
Move the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The next action item is the second amendment to the professional services agreement for environmental services at Ironwood. As Wade stated, we closed on the property. We do have a couple of environmental areas that we had evaluated. We did some phase two testing. We have a little bit of cleanup work to do. We have a contract with Terracon for the professional environmental services to clean up the additional amounts and areas. The recommended action falls in the mid-top portion of page 13 to finish up the cleanup.
Move to approve the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next is authorization of a land acquisition. This is in Big Creek Parkway. As the commissioners have known, this corridor along the Fowles Road area, the Lake to Lake Trail, Lake Abram to Lake Isaac, has been an area of interest for the park district, continuing to buffer the trail. This particular property is right next to it, and the trail goes right in front of it. The owners came to us and asked if we would be interested in purchasing the property. It gives us a very nice buffer and actually cleans up a little bit of the views going into the intersection. The recommended action to purchase the property in the Big Creek area falls on the bottom portion of page 13.
Excuse me, you mean vehicular views for drivers?
Correct. It's both, because the way it comes, you actually go and then you have to turn almost to a 90. So that property, we may move it over. We've also looked at potentially reestablishing it, moving it the other way. So by the acquisition of property, so this one may get realigned, and then it may get realigned all the way down to Millstream as well.
Nice.
Kind of big picture.
Yeah, thank you.
Move to approve the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the award of RFP 6767-B. This is the design builder for the Cleveland Metro Parks Baldwin Creek. This project was in partnership with the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District. We've got funding support through the Ohio EPA, the WRRSP. This continues to be a theme along that particular corridor. Again, the partnership became very strong. We vetted three design builders. We did end up settling on Biohabitats after the RFP analysis went through. They are being ranked Biohabitats as best value for 6767-B. Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 16.
Move to approve the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next is the Old Lorraine Connector Trail Project Development Agreement. This project dates back further than 2022, we have been looking at this as a direct connection to our Little Met golf course and access into the Rocky River Reservation. This is a key area that we have been studying for a period of time. Cam's Corner, a partner, was awarded $750,000 through the ARPA community grant funding from Cuyahoga County District 2 to use on the process. On the project, they've also attained $750,000 commitment from the City of Cleveland. We are their strong partner. We will continue to work with not only Cam's Corner, but the Cleveland Clinic Foundation on the development agreement to make sure that we can provide the right build aspect for the Lorraine Road connector, one of the key connectors into the park district. It currently doesn't exist in a fashion that's acceptable. It's literally the road. They have repaved the road, which is a positive, and now we're going to work on establishing a trail connection.
Nice.
Recommended action falls on the top portion of page 17. Dan Moore will abstain.
Move to approve.
Well, then I move to approve, or you're moving to approve, so I have second. Thank you. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next amendment is contract 1541, professional services agreement for Gorilla Primate Forest. This is our longstanding sesquicentennial project. This is the board approved the contract back in 2020 with Van Aken Architects. This is for the next level of guaranteed maximum price as we continue to move this forward. This is going to result in a new gorilla habitat, new front entrance. We're working on the orangutan. So this is the next phases in our project, committing ourselves to hit our timeline of start of construction next year. This is a very big project for the zoo's 150th anniversary coming up. The recommended action falls in the bottom portion of page 18.
Brian, can I ask a question? How much have we raised for this? How much of this money have we raised so far?
So on the philanthropy side, we're very close to $18 million from the outside. Cleveland Metro Parks is committed through its capital funding through this last levy cycle, $4.5 million per year over the 10-year levy cycle. We also will add shuttered venue grant money and then the sponsorship from Cross Country Mortgage. That totals just north of $70 million. So we're close to the $80, $85 million. We've got about $110, $120 million goal. We've got state capital asks and they continue to raise funds. So we're well on our way. We feel we're in a very good position to hit these first phases and these timelines the way they've been established.
Very good. Move to approve the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is the contract amendment 1629 design builder for Cleveland Metro Parks Manikiki Management Center, North Chagrin. This is the GMP number 4 for the Manikiki Electric Barn. To Dan's point this morning, we continue to look at opportunities to continue to improve our properties. Manikiki itself is in the top 25 of best municipal golf courses in the country, and we continue to put net profit back into the golf courses along the way. We've improved Seneca, we've improved Sleepy Hollow, we've improved Manikiki, we've done major renovations to Washington. We look forward to finishing the last 9 at Seneca next year, but this will be the last portion of this for the cart barn, that the carts will show up next year, and this will be an all electric fleet. So we look forward to that. Recommended action falls in the bottom portion of page 20 for the GMP number 4 for Hummel.
Move to approve.
Second.
Just a question. Can we sort of blackboard what we're saving by going this route?
I'll have Sean tie that in.
Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. So we have been working with Hummel as the design build partner on this project from the beginning. And what we are able to save in terms of the ability to add this component to the contract in the fashion that we are, first and foremost is the ability to actually build it. What we have found in the market is that we are not seeing the coverage on competitively bid projects that we would like to see. We're seeing, especially with this specific type of construction, which is more or less a pole barn style, we attempted to bid a project like this at Seneca and saw almost no bid coverage on it. So from a point of savings, we're probably saving between 10 and 20% overall, but the big point is we're actually able to build it with the crew we already have on site. So that's really the difference in getting the project done.
Great. Thank you.
So your own people are building this thing?
So Hummel, the design builder who has done the campus of management center, will be the builder for this one specifically.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of money. How big is it?
From a square footage standpoint, I would believe we're a bit over 10,000 square feet. Now, when it comes down to what we're actually spending, we have electrical components because this is electrical cart barn. We have all the components, the slab, the building itself. We feel that what we are investing in this project here compared to what we've paid for other structures of similar type, especially what was done at Big Met with the electric cart barn there, that we are, when you look at the construction trends, we're getting a very good price for this project specifically compared to what we've done elsewhere.
Okay, it does seem high though, doesn't it? Having built a few barns.
Knowing what we're seeing in the entire market for construction costs, you know, sometimes now looking up to $300-$400 a square foot, when 4 or 5 years ago we were budgeting $200 a square foot, we're pretty confident with.
Okay,
that's huge. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item is contract amendment 1558, construction manager at risk, Cleveland Metro Parks, Garfield Park, Garfield Park Reservation. This is the GMP number 6. This has been vetted many times over. These are for the complete construction documents for the fishing dock program center and flat work, Garfield program utility, and final shaping of the pond. This project has really come to life. The project with Neroni will come to a finish, and then Shermer is already working on the Garfield Pond Program Center. So this will finish up our work at Garfield Park Reservation. Recommended action falls on the top portion of page 22.
Move to approve the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next is the tabulation of award and bids. I will not read all of them unless there are any questions. Golf merchandise, point of sale system, ice cream, financial services, compact tractors, really getting ourselves prepared for the next season. The recommended action falls on the top portion of page 23.
Move to approve the motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Vouchers and payroll.
Thank you, Brian. On the top of page 50, commissioners, you will see resolution 23-11-175 in the amount of $17,500,227.16. All the vouchers have been reviewed as to legality of the expenditure, and they conform with the Ohio Revised Code. I would ask your approval.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The second resolution is resolution 23-11-176 in the amount of $431.22. Again, the vouchers have been reviewed as to legality of expenditure and conform with the Ohio Revised Code. These are payments to Arborware.
Move to approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Dan Moore abstained.
Very well. Public comments?
And Commissioner, let me just remind you that I think several people have come in after the sign-in sheet, and if we have more than 10 people, it's within your purview to, you know, conduct the public comment period in an orderly process. So we do have our 3-minute sign available if you want to use that. We can see how things go. Karen can keep time, and she's got a 30-second sort of warning thing too. So all within your discretion as president of the board.
We don't plan to keep a stopwatch, but you get the idea. So, yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Norm Polanski from Major Hoople's, family-run business in the flats for 42 years, neighbor to the Irish Town Bend project. Coming here again to ask you to keep the parking lot that's across from us a parking lot in the future, because it's very essential to my business, and I also think it's beneficial to the public to use. And if it stays a parking lot, I also will help keep it clean and safe for the public. And I know that plans are always changing, because the original one just had a playground in it that has been moved to somewhere else in your 20-acre park, probably for safety due to it being close to a busy intersection. But the new plan has 2 more trails going through it. So that will give us 3 trails running parallel in a close proximity to each other. One that's on Franklin that eliminated street parking, and 2 in the new park that you're planning on building. And just for the board to know that when it went through the approval process of the city of Cleveland, many comments were submitted about parking. And there were comments also submitted on behalf of Hoople's, wondering if we had a future in the area and the ability to stay afloat, which I appreciate the public doing that. And I know there is also now a counter proposal to say that there's going to be a parking garage built at the hospital on West 25th in their large parking lot. There's also a possibility of a developer building more housing up there. So if a parking garage is built, I would assume that the employees would hopefully have designated spots for themselves. And then if a developer builds there, his tenants will probably have paid spots. So the parking garage will almost be full before any of the public gets to use it. So if the board can find in its way to help push along a parking lot across from Hoople's, it would be beneficial to me and to the public to use in that area. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Good morning.
Morning. Sorry I was late. I had to drop my son off at school. My name is Anthony Beard. I've spoken about my experience with the Metro Parks, very positive experience I've had over the years living in the Metro, living next to the Metro Parks, living at Euclid Beach. I have here something. One thing I have to commend you because I like the way you put a lot into your meetings. You pack a lot in. And we have something in common because I'm a pack rat also. And I have here that everyone can't see is the placard that I received in the mail that's asked, the Metro Parks asked me to support issue 5 and how important the Metro Parks is as a entity here in Northeast Ohio and really all across the country. And I'm happy to say that I did vote yes for issue 5 to allow the Metro Parks to expand, protect, and continue and maintain and improve its services. And so as part of the community, I said yes to the Metro Parks, and I like for the Metro Parks to say yes to me. And I'll get that later on because I just returned from Mobile Home Action Network meeting in Washington, D.C. last week. And I met a lot of people across the country who live in mobile home communities. And one thing that stood out is that there, I met a lot of people who live in a resident-owned community. If you don't know, resident-owned communities are communities that the residents, instead of paying rent to a renter, the residents pay into a community that they formed themselves. And it's backed by an organization called Rock USA. I'm bringing that up because Rock USA, if you don't know, is an organization that funds and supports residents of building these resident-owned communities with various funding initiatives. And most specifically, two things that I want to bring up is the Price Act. There's a congressman who retired, and he formed put legislation forward to funding specifically for infrastructure building of these resident home communities. You can look it up, the Price Act, and that money is still available, still in the process of being distributed, and that funding is available. Also, it just came out that a local bank, KeyBank, has put forth, I believe it's $150,000 towards specifically towards mobile home communities to build, develop infrastructure in that nature. I'm bringing all this up is because the United Residents of Euclid Beach has an alternative plan. And in our alternative plan, we can use a small portion of the 28 acres that are at Euclid Beach and form a resident-owned community. This is something that we're, this is not new. This is part of our original set of asks. Long time ago, way over a year and a half ago, we had these asks that we had in place, but nobody has listened to us. And so in closing, we have the support of not only a lot of residents, I see a lot of my neighbors here, there's a lot of community individuals who are here, and we have the support of sending out over 6,000 letters on our petition that we have on the internet. And so what I'm asking of you is to say yes, as we say yes to you with the issue 5, say yes to a meeting so we can show you what our alternative plan is. And it's a possibility that you will come into a partnership with us to implement this alternative plan. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Leonard Trapney. I'm from Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park 2, and mine's pretty quick. I'm just saying I found a place to leave, you know, because I just don't have the money to go. You know, it's like we're waiting on this grant money, but I found a place to move to. I can leave this weekend, but I can't, you know, because the money's tied up. That's all I have to say.
All right, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Carol McLean. I'm a retiree. I'm also a resident at Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park. First, I have to say to you guys, you probably don't know, but the main problem we're having out there right now is demolition. They're demolishing homes that are no longer being used at Euclid Beach. But in the process of doing that, it's causing a lot of disarray and stuff for the folks that are there. It's almost like we're living in a war zone. And it's not fair to us. I don't know why they're demolishing things at this point, but what we probably want to have happen is wait until we leave that site, if we're going to have to leave. Anthony Beard just gave you a summary of what would happen if we stay in the park. And that's a wonderful thing. I hope you guys will, you know, consider that. But if you don't consider that, we have a lot of residents that are there. There are 118 properties out there right now, and we all have to relocate. As Leonard got up here and said, he's not able to relocate because the money has not been distributed. We had a meeting last Thursday, and Mr. Rob, who is the property manager, he said that some of the monies have been released to him through that Mandel Foundation. If it's been released, release it to us, because we need those money to settle into a new home, if that's what we have to do. Home is where the heart is. I've only been out there 8 years because I'm a retiree, but I love living out there. It's a beautiful place. I appreciate all the things that the Metro Parks has done to help us, but we need additional help. We need you to look into what's happening out there with the demolition. That's very important. There's wires hanging. We have big piles of debris all over, and that's not healthy nor good for us, not for our mental state or our physical state. So I just want to thank you for the things that you're doing for the community. As we drove out here, there's all kind of beautiful things on the west side. We want those same beautiful things on the east side. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Marge Mysak, and I'm a 33-year resident of Cuyahoga County and of the city of Cleveland. And I've always been a strong supporter of the Metro Parks. As a resident of Cleveland, I've been especially glad for the many initiatives that you've taken in recent years to expand your footprint and programming and access to nature for in the city of Cleveland. The recent actions that have been in your name in relation to Euclid, the Euclid Beach resident mobile home park, in order to expand the Euclid Creek Reservation, have created, though, inequities that you can alter. The recent decision by the Western Reserve Land Conservancy have been in your name to use the guidelines of the Federal Uniform Relocation Act in closing down the park is one step in an equitable response, towards an equitable response. But today I'm asking for your support to set aside a portion of that land, and it's a very large portion of land that you've acquired, to set aside a small portion of that land for a new Euclid Beach mobile home park, as Anthony has described, to be controlled by residents. The Euclid Beach, I've gotten to know a lot of these residents over the past month as I've sat with them as they've been working to organize around this issue in order to stay or in order to be treated fairly as they've been told that they would be displaced. They've poured their hearts and their life savings into homes, and they've created a community that takes care of one another. It's affordable housing there that is in a region that's woefully too little affordable housing. And the Metro Parks is the ultimate landowner in the Euclid Creek project. And you could play a deciding role in preserving the Euclid Beach mobile home community, while also expanding access to the Lake Erie lakefront. We could really have both, and you can create that, and I'm asking you to do that. I urge you, as the controlling body of the Cleveland Metro Parks, to stand with the residents of the Euclid Beach Mobile Home Community and help create a just solution that preserves a portion of the site for their homes while also expanding the public park. Again, we can do both. We can be a region that expands equity for all of our residents in terms of access to the lakefront for Eastside residents and access to affordable housing for the residents of the Euclid Beach Mobile Home Community in order to preserve their homes. There are resources nationally for them, and I urge you to help create that just solution. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Josiah Quarles. I work with the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless and have over the past year plus gotten to know a lot of these residents, gotten to know the area, and gotten to know the project. And I believe that the project has good goals to create, like what Carol said, some beautiful things on the east side. More accessibility, better view of the lake, to let people know that they do have access. I mean, there is access right now, but it's hard to see that it's there. But in this process, I've discovered that this sort of end goal has skipped over individual lives and homes and families, and they must be appreciated. If we want to do something nice on the east side, we have to consider the east siders that are there. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to say we want access to a lakefront and then the people on the lakefront who live there kick them out. What you could do as a body that I think would be extremely helpful is to just give a heads up that it would be okay if you didn't have the entirety of the park. I think from that point, like, conversations could happen. So I call on this body to make some statement in that regard or schedule some sort of meeting so that some planning can actually take place. It's difficult to plan something in theory when there is no access to what you will need to plan for from the end user or from the current owner. These asks have been made to Western Reserve Land Conservancy for very simple things, as such as an engineering report, so we could actually know what the upfront cost would be. So if this is completely not feasible, then we walk away and we do something else and no one's spinning their wheels. But that transparency has never been there. So I emphatically ask this body to please meet with residents, the representatives, other community members. There was a whole steering committee behind this that have a lot of important people that have a lot of expertise and a lot of money. This is an opportunity to craft a new and intentional mobile home park that would preserve the affordable housing, expand the affordable housing, expand home ownership, and build a community based upon stewardship that put people and parks in connection and would open up tons of opportunity for job creation, for education, and for folks to remain in the community that they call home. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is William Hart, and I've been before the board before. I listened to your concerns about the golf courses, and someday look forward to taking the title that Tiger Woods has as a golfer. But my most concern is not playing golf, not golf course, but the real people that live at the Euclid Beach Mobile Park, such as myself. It was brought to my attention that they were turning over the 28 acres in which we live on. If they're turning over 28 acres given to the Metro Parks, then like all the other members here say, would you consider giving us 8 of those acres on the front part and you can still do what you need to do? I guess the closet question is, why are we here? Well, we're here because of one thing that was brought to my attention and I bring up in all the meetings. One of the people who put forth the finances to purchase the Euclid Beach Mobile Park now sits on the board of the Metro Park, which is Miss, your name? Miss Itu, is that how you pronounce that? And what was your compassion to do when you guys purchased the Metro Park, I mean, the Euclid Beach Mobile Park? Did you consider the residents that live there? Nobody came out and talked to us about we're purchasing the mobile park and what do you guys think we should do in helping you out? Nobody came and said anything to us. We found out it was like a rainy day. The park has been sold. We're going to have to get out. A lot of the older, elderly people there, they became very scared. I was ready for battle. I'm trying to figure out what can I do to protect my neighbors, my family, and all those in the community in which we call home. I've been living there for 17 years. And I recall one week I went on what I called a vacation. I was gone for a whole week. And my neighbor called me 3 days after leaving and said, your front door has been open for 3 days. Where are you at? I said, I'm on vacation, but I had no worries. Now I worries. 4:30 this morning, I woke up and it sounded like an actual war zone. They were tearing down mobile homes, dumping them into the dumpster at 4:30 in the morning. There's a lot of elderly people living there. No consideration at all. And I just want to say to you, Ms. Itu, how you pronounce your last name? You sit now on the board. Would you take some type of compassion in assisting us if we have to leave, assisting us in comfortable places where we can go? Mr. Leonard found a home. He'll never find another home like that for $14,000. Who lives in a home for $14,000? He's comfortable with that. A beautiful home, if you look at it. Did you bring the paper with you?
I didn't bring it.
Okay. So he found a beautiful home for $14,000, and they appraised his home at less than $1,800 and told him, this is what we're going to give you. $1,800 to purchase the home where he comfortable in another mobile park, which is not far from here. And now they're going to sell that home because they're not going to hold it for him for $14,000. Soon as somebody come with that money, they're going to sell that home. And then he'll be back out looking again to find somewhere else to live, just like the rest of us. So I just ask Ms. Itu and all the board members to consider us. You've been given 28 acres of land. If you can't give us 8 acres, please assist us in a comfortable move out of where we plan on spending the rest of our lives at. Thank you.
Thank you.
And just to clarify the record, there's thank you for your comments. Yeah. But there's not an action item before the board at this time regarding this matter. So any ethics issues we would carefully vet, you know, down the road. So there's no action item pending. You're raising her role in the past, but there's no action item right now before the board, and we always vet any issues very seriously. So thank you for bringing that issue up, but it's not appropriate at this time. And just to clarify the record too, we have not been given that land. We are not the land owner at this time.
And I truly understand that, but in the very near future, you will be the land owner of the Metro Park because it will be the Metro Park. I mean, we can say what you don't right now, but in the near future, Mobile Home Park will be a part of the Metro Park. And we're not trying to overpower ourselves and everything. Well, they may not take that part. In the very near future, that's going to be a beautiful part of what you guys are known to do, make the land very beautiful. And that's going to be where we live at. It's going to be a beautiful part of the Metro Parks in the very near future.
You guys parked a 130-year-old ship right in my fishing hole.
Do we have anyone else? Marty? Morning.
They speak very well with just prompt cards. I don't. I saw the segment, TV segment, on how the elephants learn to cooperate with routine treatments. Not new, but worth repeating for the public. Also mentioned was work done to develop non-invasive cortisol testing for monitoring stress levels. Both are praiseworthy, but need to be applied in present situations. Are the stress levels tracked to determine the effects of the loud and late light shows? Seems likely these are indeed stressful and may disrupt normal circadian rhythms, possibly contributing to acute or chronic illness or affecting fertility. Raising money for animal welfare at the cost of injuring them is not a good approach. an example of how deadly stress can be. The matriarch of the St. Louis elephants died after a loose dog harassed her herd. This was just a small dog. Good thing we don't have any dogs running loose at the zoo. The responsibility to care for zoo animals, along with those in the parks, surely presupposes not adding to their threats. Deer numbers are managed to protect the ecosystem and habitat for other creatures. What could be more obvious than requiring bird-safe glass when designing your buildings so that birds don't kill themselves hitting windows? Nature centers, the new zoo auditorium, how inexcusable to not make that effort while you fundraise for the future of wildlife. Bird watching is a huge draw for Metro Parks. It is a huge blot on your conservation claims to be able to address this, to fail to address this. You shouldn't need an ordinary citizen calling you to task over protecting our already threatened bird populations. You shouldn't need citizens attending and revelations that you worked on the QT yet Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park while planning to have the residents evicted. You claim to care about neighborhoods while destroying one. If your core principles are more than marketing models, then you must walk the walk and lead by setting an example. At $250 million, you can afford to do the right thing. Actions speak louder than words, and failure to act is pretty darn incriminating. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Wayne Cater, and I'm a resident of the Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park. I'm a little confused because I'm hearing that Metro Park is going to acquire the mobile home park, but the owners are the Western Reserve Conservatory. But I'm here to, if you can relay a message to the Western Reserve Conservatory, is that I fear for my health, I fear for the danger of my neighbors and colleagues, is that all this construction that's going on over there is bad for our health. It looks like a war zone, as Carol said, around there. And they come and they work in, as Will said, 4 o'clock in the morning. They, on a Sunday, they came there and I asked the guy if he could not work on a Sunday. And he said, well, every day is a work day to him. And shortly after that, his machine hits a electrical power line and knocks everybody power out. Now, that could have been a real danger in there. I've always felt safe in the park, but now I feel unsafe with all this construction and destruction going on over there. These people are my family. And as Will said, we can leave. I leave my door open, even at night. Nothing to worry about. It's a real safe community over there. But if we move out of there, it's not as safe out in the mainstream of the area. So I'm asking also if we can, if whoever has this park, if we can retain a small area of it to have a community-based mobile home park for ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes.
Hi, I'm Amy Callahan, and I work at Waterloo Arts, which is a small arts nonprofit in the Collinwood neighborhood, and we run the Waterloo Arts Fest. And I just want to say that this has been so frustrating, this whole experience, and I know I don't have a lot of time to talk here. So if anyone is interested in getting the perspective of somebody that is not part of the mobile home park, but is in the community, I would be really happy to talk to you and have a very civil conversation, no matter sort of what your perspective is. And you could just reach out to me at Waterloo Arts. But we recently had an exhibit in our art gallery about the mobile home community. And so for about a month and a half, I walked by an image that was taken by a photographer in our neighborhood, Bridget Caswell. And if it was of Alice, who is a 98-year-old resident of the community. And I gotta tell you, it is just really like heartbreaking to think that that person is gonna have to move out of her mobile home. You know, it's just, I'm sure all of you have moved in your life and you know how hard that is. And at that age, it just doesn't seem right that we should be asking her to do that. And I know that the timeline here has been presented as a sort of long timeline, this 18 months, because it's put in the perspective of the 3 months that is required by law. And I want to put it in a different time frame. And that's really of like a 50-year time frame. I mean, if you think about this, then half of Alice's lifetime, that neighborhood has been in decline. So to have the entities like the Metro Parks and the Western Reserve and sort of the people that are the decision makers in our community, and really how many people view as the gatekeepers of a lot of funding in the neighborhood, to have you come in at this moment and say, like, 18 months is plenty of time, we're gonna like come into your community and take care of things and make it good and do all the things that everybody's been asking for, and we just have to get rid of Alice. Like, that just doesn't seem right. There's got to be another way. And so one of the reasons that I've been given for why this timeline has to happen is that the infrastructure is so bad in the community that it's not a safe place for someone like Alice to live, and that it would be too expensive to fix that infrastructure in order to allow for a longer transition time period. And it's very frustrating that none of the data, there has been no data, there has been no engineer's report, there's been no information given to the community about that decision-making process. So there are many people that I talk to in the community that are frustrated and feel like they haven't been walked through that decision-making process because no information has been provided. And I know I don't want to take too much time here, but I just want to leave you on one note, which is that we did reach out to a civil engineer who works in Pittsburgh, and he prepared a little letter that says what should have been done in assessing the park and what the infrastructure needs are. In his estimate, in the worst case scenario, where you would have to replace all of the water lines for each residential unit, it would be $10,000 a unit. At the time, like, that was 130 units. That's $130,000. That is just so much lower than the wildly exaggerated numbers that have come out from the Land Conservancy. And no report has ever been shown to the community. So it's just, I feel like we all need to step back and take a minute to ask those important questions, because, you know, you can throw around a lot of numbers, and when you're basing your decision, this is your legacy. It's all of our legacy, honestly, but you're the decision makers. You're the ones at the table, and you should have good data to make those decisions on. So like I said, if anyone wants to talk to me more about this, I would so love to give you my perspective and some other ideas for how this could move forward. But there are more ideas. I feel like there's sort of an inevitability about this that doesn't need to be there. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Nestrick. I'm the executive director of the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless. The Metro Parks, I'm a dreamer. I think Cleveland needs a place of dreamers. And I'm so thankful for how the Metro Parks have dreamt of a place that is accessible to my family who lives in Cleveland, to all the residents of the city of Cleveland, to make nature green spaces accessible. I remember going out and looking for tadpoles with my two little kids. I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old last spring throughout the Metro Parks, going to Rock River, all these places, trying to find where are the tadpoles growing, you know, and trying to show our family what nature is like in the wild. And I have another dream. That one day I could go to Euclid Beach with my kids. And I can look at Euclid Beach and say, look what was created. This was created by a fantastic organization that didn't make it an either or. Didn't make it whether the residents can stay because the park has to be there. But I can walk through the park and be like, look what the Metro Parks did. Look what they created. They created the most innovative solution in the nation to make sure that longtime residents continue to remain in their homes while creating a beautiful park. I want to walk through that park with my kids and be like, this is the world that we can create here in Cleveland. It doesn't have to be people that live there or parks. It can be both. It is an example to all of Cleveland, all of the nation, that we can choose people and we can choose parks. In a city where affordable housing is almost impossible to find right now, the Metro Parks could lead the way in helping create a solution for naturally occurring affordable housing in our community and the park. And so I'm here to like share that dream with you, that I can bring my kids there and be like, this is when we chose people and parks. The same way as I take my kids to be like, this is how tadpoles grow in the Metro Parks, we can also talk about innovative, amazing solutions that both respect the residents and the need for green space in our community. Thank you for dreaming with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Juan, Ryan?
Very first information briefing item we have is the 2024 budget preview. Thanks, Wade?
Brian. Thank you, Brian. There we go. Commissioners, my hope this morning is to just briefly give you an idea of what's going to be coming forward in December as it relates to the budget and where we stand. This is a process that started back in late August, included all the various operational units of the park district. Many of my fellow chiefs are here. They were intimately involved, their directors and managers. And I think it goes without saying that any good, well-constructed budget is a team effort, and you have a very good team. This was a very collaborative process. And my hope is, as the messenger of where we are, is that when we get to December, there's really no surprises in what you're going to be seeing. There we go.
If I could, the 23 estimated amounts will be included in your final budget presentation. They're not going to be discussed today. We're 10 months in. Once we get 11 months in, I'll have a much better feel. Capital project rollovers from 23 to 24 will be finalized before the December board meeting. We're doing that work now to find out where we stand in particular projects. And Commissioner Itu asked about that earlier. Those will be carried forward, so they haven't been booked as expenses, but the money is reserved for that. Any restricted funds will be budgeted if the amounts are known. An example would be the Mandel funds that we've received. We would budget those, but if we don't know the exact amount, we won't budget those until the cash is available. Our budget book, which is submitted to the GFOA for the Distinguished Budget Award, has to be filed 90 days after the approval of the budget. This year, our target date to file that is February 29th, since it's a leap year. I suggested that we give Sybil Haney, our budget director, an extra day. So we'll file that on the 29th. At the highest level, our baseline operating budget next year will be $133.7 million approximately. I thought it was good to give a frame of reference of where we've come in the last 10 years. So I pulled the 10-year budget that was discussed with this board. And one of the things that I noted right away was the budget was approved in March of the subsequent year. It used to be a budget was approved to operate, and then the final budget was usually approved in March. That budget was $74.5 million. Next year will be budgeting approximately $29 million for new capital projects, not the carryover. These are new plus carryover. The real amount is $28,850,000. 10 years ago, that amount was $15 million. So you can just see the sheer growth in the organization. In terms of capital, our capital equipment allocations next year will be $5.2 million. And I think I should stop. There are capital needs that go beyond that, but we have to figure out what can we afford in our budget and then determine which capital pieces of capital equipment can we afford to do this year. 10 years ago, that amount was $3.3 million. Land acquisitions are budgeted at $2.5 million right now for next year. Land acquisitions in 2014 were $3.4 million. So you might wonder, why is the amount a little lower? Land acquisitions last year were higher than $2.5 million, as you know. When opportunities present themselves and we have available resources, we look to the board for approval to make that purchase. But right now we can afford $2.5 million in our current budget as it stands. When you compare the operating budget that's going to be proposed to what we have currently, it's $133.7 million. That's the operating, not counting capital. Last year's original budget was $124 million. The revised budget, which is the budget we're operating under right now, is 132.6. So you can see there's not a lot of increase in the operating expenses of the organization in terms of what we budgeted. The year-to-date actual spend is $100 million, $100.5 million. I think when we get to the end of the year, what we'll end up booking will be about $120 to $125 million. So we'll come in below budget. And so there will be some growth going into next year, but not dramatic growth, modest growth. I'm estimating revenues next year at $161.1 million. We're noting modest increases in property taxes. Now that the levy's been set, you'll realize additional property tax revenue from new construction, modest increases in charges for services. A lot of that we're starting to get toward capacity when we talk about golf and things like that. And we've tried to keep our rates at an amount and at a rate that's appropriate. And we hope to see some increase in interest earnings. Although if the Fed keeps doing what it's doing and short-term interest rates keep going down, that might flatten out. Currently to date, year-to-date revenues through October are $167.2 million. And right away you go, wow, that's less than you're budgeting for next year. A big chunk of that and a lot of credit needs to go to Natalie because in the grants, and in the giving space, we can't book that if we don't know it. So that $161 million may go up if grants are awarded to us and won or additional contributions are made. Year-to-date revenues last year at this time were only $127 million. So you can see that just speaks to how strong this year has been. A breakdown in how that money is allocated, $68.5 million, 51% of the baseline budget is going to salaries. Employee benefits is another $21.1 million, 16%. 14% of that is the OPERS contribution that's made on behalf of employees of the 16%. Healthcare costs are going to be approximately $9 million, which is 7% of the baseline budget. And as you heard last month from Matt Hawes, that went up very minimally, about 1.5%. So we've done a good job at maintaining our healthcare costs. A couple highlights in some of our bigger units. The zoo's expenditures are budgeted at $26 million next year. Slight increase of 5.8% for a variety of reasons, but a big part of that's due to the inflationary costs of the things that are needed to run the zoo. Next year, we'll be bringing back the dinosaur exhibit after a few year hiatus, and that'll have an economic impact to us of $650,000. And we anticipate some modest increases in charges for services and concession revenue next year. There we go. And the last unit I wanted to touch on was golf. Golf's expenditures are budgeted at $10.9 million. We took over Ironwood Golf Course, which we talked about earlier on November 3rd. And so the 2024 budget will include a budget for Ironwood for a full year. So there will be an increase in the golf budget because we have one additional golf course. Again, we anticipate greens fees and other related revenues to increase, and we budget that at a modest increase based upon the rates that were approved by the commissioners at the last meeting. And with that, I would see if there are any questions in anticipation of the budget, but it's a good budget that allows for the necessary capital expenditures, but not dramatic increases in our operating expenditures. And again, I would be remiss if I didn't recognize the finance staff, Controller Gary Butzbach, Budget Director Sybil Haney, and all of the chiefs, because again, I'm merely the messenger. A good budget's a team effort, and you've got a great team, and the chiefs have been excellent in helping craft a budget that we can afford and present to you with confidence.
Thank you. We good?
Next info item is a summary of zoo conservation funds for 2023. Chris?
All right. Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
This time of year, I always try to come up and talk about the conservation impact that the zoo has had. A lot of that is financial. We want you to understand where the finances are coming from and where they're going. But also talk a little bit about the program structure and the impact. So overall, when we look at our institutional conservation strategy, the objectives of the zoo's conservation program focus on wildlife. Obviously, we're a zoo, but protecting that wildlife, a lot of that work comes through enhancing people. So what we do is a lot of our programs are built on not only supporting general operating support for conservation organizations that we vetted that fits in with our mindset, but also building conservation capacity. So building conservation capacity in terms of education programs and training, and then doing and promoting conservation and science to help be able to protect that wildlife. And a lot of that protection comes through anti-poaching patrols, through people, through resources, that sort of stuff. The funding structure, two-thirds, in some cases more, of the funding for these programs comes from Cleveland Zoological Society. That's membership revenue as well as philanthropic gifts. On the Metro Parks side, we use restricted funds. No operational dollars from the Metro Parks, from the levy, go towards these international species conservation programs. We don't use levy dollars for that. Instead, we use a combination of funds that come from donations, from events, from our Quarters for Conservation program. All of those build out the funds that we contribute to these programs year over year. And in general, the structure of the program consists of 6 key Future for Wildlife programs, as well as some smaller dollar conservation partnerships. So, you know, as we look at the funding strategy, I mentioned this, the Zoological Society provides membership revenue and then additional funds through philanthropy and event investments. And then, you know, our funds come from a variety of different sources. A couple of things to mention that sort of show up on an opportunistic basis. For example, we raised $1,600 for bison conservation by naming our baby bison this year. We raised over $19,000 for the Future for Wildlife 5K race that we hosted in the fall. So a number of those funds come together. The last line there I'll talk about briefly is we have AZA safe funds. those are basically pass-through funds where other zoos contribute to AZA SAFE programs, and SAFE stands for Saving Animals from Extinction. Those are species-level conservation programs that we lead. Our staff members lead those programs and organize those programs, and those donations come from other zoos. We hold them and contribute them on behalf of the program at the end of the year. These are our six core programs. Asian turtles, wildlife trafficking mitigation, lions and cheetah, giraffe, and then I have gorilla and Indian bear highlighted because those are programs that our staff take more of an active role in. They're either leading those programs or driving those programs in a way that's not just providing funds for them. So one of those future for wildlife programs, the Asian turtle program, actually Dr. Mike Selig was able to go to Vietnam this year and provide veterinary care and veterinary training. Much of what the Asian turtle program does is basically rescue and rehab of endangered species of turtle. We work with the Swin Ho's soft-shelled turtle, which is the most endangered turtle species in the world. They think that there are fewer than 5 individuals left in the world. We also work with the Vietnamese pond turtle and assure its colonies. We are a founding member of the Turtle Survival Alliance, which basically, again, provides rescue and support, often supporting law enforcement agencies. You'll see that there are many wildlife trafficking laws that are out there, but if there's not a place for those confiscated animals to go, law enforcement officers often look the other way, because what are they going to do with a shipment of 100 turtles that they were just confiscating? So what Turtle Survival Alliance does is provide care, rehab, and potentially reintroduction for those animals that get confiscated, and they operate all over the world. Lion and cheetah program. We work with lion landscapes. Traditionally, we had worked with a program called Ruaha Carnivore Project, and they merged with Lion Landscapes in 2021. Basically, what both Lion Landscapes and Action for Cheetahs Kenya do is support the people who live around these carnivores. So this is very similar to some of the things you're seeing in the American West with wolf reintroduction. Basically, what these programs are designed is to help people protect their cattle, their livestock, and be able to provide a livelihood and be able to provide support for any losses that are incurred via cheetah or lion. And what that allows to do is prevent retaliation killings to help support those individual animals. And one of the ways that we're able to support this program is our Lights for Lions program, where right now we're collecting broken and unused holiday lights. We collect them from October through the end of the year, actually into the beginning of the year. We recycle those lights with a partner, and the cash that's created by recycling those lights goes directly to support lion and cheetah conservation. Wow. The illegal wildlife trade program is a program that we've been working on for years. We're a founding member of the AZA Wildlife Trafficking Alliance, but we also do a tremendous amount of work with a number of small programs. So just a couple of highlights here. Education for Nature Vietnam is a network of volunteers in Vietnam that report and track wildlife crime. This is a network of over 4,000 volunteers that's provided closure on over 10,000 legal cases around wildlife trafficking in Vietnam. We help support that program. The Little Fireface program is a program that looks at the impact of social media on the trade, the illegal pet trade of lorises. So they're looking at that from a social media side. The Tiger Conservation Campaign is a program that really supports tigers in the China, Russia, the Amur Valley area, looking at human wildlife conflict and anti-poaching patrols. So all of these projects are supported to really help reduce that wildlife trade and to be able to help support the species by protecting the wildlife. Giraffe is a program that we put nearly $190,000 into this year. Most of that comes from the generous donation of an individual through Cleveland Zoological Society. But Giraffe Conservation Foundation is still the only wildlife conservation organization dedicated completely to the conservation of giraffe. We know now that there are multiple species of giraffe that are endangered, or subspecies of giraffe that are endangered. So working on helping support that organization and help supporting giraffe conservation. There are actually fewer giraffe in the wild than there are elephants. You don't often hear that because giraffe are pretty easy to spot, but the numbers are actually declining pretty rapidly. One of the programs, the Twiga Watu Initiative, is the training of veterinarians. in Africa, so African veterinarians to be able to support their wildlife, and then environmental education training around a reserve in Kenya to help support giraffe conservation. Our two big programs that we have staff really involved in are the gorilla program and then the Andean bear conservation program. And we've been working with the Fosse Fund for over 20 years. Kristen Lucas is really key to this. And I just want to kind of give a couple facts here. We've been working with the Memoirs program, which is basically a college-based conservation training program out of the University of Rwanda. Over the past 9 years, I had 7 staff participate in training, and we've helped produce 71 students through the Memoirs program. And this is particularly important in a country that lost an entire generation of educated individuals through the genocide in the 90s. So our team is really proactive in that. We provide core support. We provide support for the Growers Gorilla program that the Fosse Fund raises. But, you know, I've had the opportunity to be associated with Fosse Fund staff a couple of times over the past month. We're actually able to bring a couple Fosse Fund staff to the U.S., and they actually participated in certified interpretive guide training that our outdoor education team provided. And Kristen Lucas is the chair of the board for the Fosse Fund currently. She also does a tremendous amount of work. She's become a Clifton Strengths trainer, and she's trained 58 African staff and 12 staff in the home office in Atlanta around StrengthsFinder. And largely that's focused on promoting gender equality and empowering people who haven't had an opportunity and aren't used to working in a more corporate world to help them work in this large and very successful organization. And then the final program is the Andean Bear Conservation Alliance. We basically founded the Andean Bear Conservation Alliance. And when I say we, I actually mean Kim Gopp, who's our curator of conservation. Kim is the lifeblood of this organization. And I usually don't speak with them because, you know, everybody loves to talk about these projects, but there's a lot of really impressive facts about this program that Kim's been involved in. We actually fund the current director of the program, Robert Marquez. Kim and Isaac Goldstein helped found the program about 20 years ago. Over the past year, what they've been doing is creating training tools to help make sure that Andean bears are monitored consistently across the 5 different range countries in the Andean Mountains, across a variety of habitat types. Just in the past year alone, they were able to do trainings in 37 protected areas across 5 countries. They trained hundreds of conservation professionals and included 14 different government agencies all around using the Andean bear as a keystone species to help support habitat and to help support livelihood in the country. So it's a really incredible program. I'm really proud of Kim and the work that she's been able to do to make this program happen. And then lastly, these are small dollar conservation projects, but they're conservation projects that either tie to a species of interest for us or a conservation partner that we've been working with over an extended period of time. Some of these are large organizations like the Snow Leopard Trust, and the Red Panda Conservation Network, but some of them are opportunistic or programs that Kim helped fund with a small grants program early on, and we continue to support them. I mentioned the Bison Conservation Program. Those funds actually went to the Eastern Shoshone Tribe in Wyoming to help support their program, which actually breeds bison. They have significant cultural and conservation importance for the tribe there. So we're looking at those opportunities. Again, these are small dollar programs, but we believe they have a really large impact. So this is a general statement about what we were able to do this year. These numbers, you know, as we're reaching the end of the year, that we may pay out more or less, but this is what we expect to pay out. Again, $655,000 come through Cleveland Zoological Society and their support. We've been able to leverage through a variety of different programs, $279,000. Again, those are not operational funds. Those aren't levy funds. Those are basically funds from outside organizations. And then just want to point out, if you're doing the math, that $935,000 number at the top, that is the Zoo Society and the Metro Parks funds only. Those are the funds that we declare as our impact. The $63,000, the AZA safe funds, we will pay out, but those are funds that are actually, they're sourced from other AZA organizations, and we're passing them through onto conservation work with either gorilla or Andean bear. So with that, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity. I'm really proud. The AZA standard is to do
between 3 to 5% of your annual operating budget and commit that to conservation. We are going to be, depending on where we finalize our budget, we're going to be in the 3.7-3.8% of our budget this year going to conservation. So I really appreciate the opportunity to do this and appreciate Brian's support to allow us to be able to work through these programs.
That's comprehensive.
I think it's great that you're doing this, and we're sort of a conduit for donations in the sense, so it isn't coming out of our budget per se, but in terms of other zoos, how do we rank in terms of how we support conservation? This is almost $1 million.
Well, there are some things that do up to 5 and 10% of their operating budget that go towards conservation programs. I'm really proud of, you know, the fact that we're funding this, but I'm most proud of the work that the team is doing to be engaged in these projects, to have Dr. Selig in Vietnam helping train, to have Kristen be involved in Rwanda, to have Kim involved in Colombia. I think those are the parts that make me most proud, because we're not just an ATM for conservation organizations.
Right.
We're actually having an
impact involved,
designing the program, helping train the individuals, helping bring individuals from those programs here and help train them. So from that perspective, I think we're extremely strong.
In terms of what we did this year, how does it compare to last year and say the year before?
This was a stronger year. So and that's largely driven by a philanthropic donation. Sometimes there's timing differences where we get the donation late in a year and aren't able to apply it in that calendar year, so it rolls over last year. So our number off the top of my head was closer to $700,000 last year. Mm-hmm. So we're up above 900 this year. That's a combination of the Zoological Society having another extremely strong membership year, but also an individual donation that helped put this through this. And that's why you see this number vary from year to year, because it depends on if you were able to secure a large philanthropic gift.
Right. I get it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chris, thank you. And thank you to Sarah and her leadership and Chris Meyerhoff at the Zoo Society. That is the last information briefing item. There is no old business. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Thursday, December 14th here in the office. There is an executive session.
Is there a motion for executive session to go into the executive session for the purposes of purchase and acquisition of real property?
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Bruce Rinker.
Yes.
Yvette Itu.
Yes.
Dan Moore.
Yes.
All right. We thank you all. There'll be no further business on which we would vote. We're back. So a motion.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Thank you.
I thought you had to come out of executive
session. Have a great Thanksgiving, everybody.